Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. Good afternoon. Carmela Keener, on behalf of the plaintiffs below, appellees, like to introduce to the court my co-counsel who are in the courtroom from Rabrowski and Long, Ms. Gina Serra.
Good afternoon.
From Saxena White, Lester Hooker.
Good afternoon.
And from the Weiser Law Firm, Patricia Weiser. Ms. Weiser has been admitted pro hoc vice and will make the presentation today on behalf of the plaintiffs below appellees.
Welcome to the court.
May it please the court, Your Honor, Victor Battaglia, Jr., local counsel. I'd like to be able, on behalf of the appellants, to introduce to the court Ms. Molly Havoc of Chitwood, Harley & Harness from Atlanta.
Welcome to the court.
Mr. Peter Bull from Bull & Lifshitz, New York.
Welcome.
And Mr. John Harness of New York and Atlanta, who will be arguing for the appellants.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
When I start the clock, you'll have your full 20 minutes. When the yellow light goes on, you'll be using the time you reserve. You can continue. Just, you know, be aware that you're using your reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. As Chancellor Allen noted many years ago in a case entitled Doby v. Keybox 5 Operatives, fiduciary law provides a set of principles that are capable of addressing ex post diverse conduct that may arise between those in a fiduciary relationship. The fundamental premise underlying all fiduciary law is that no fixed set of rules can anticipate the myriad diverse situations that may be presented when one entrusts control of his money or property to another. That principle could not be more clearly demonstrated in this case. In the transaction at issue, defendants acted not to ensure that they complied with their fiduciary duties, but merely to ensure that they complied with a procedure established by the Chancery Courts, beginning with the Siliconics case and going through Pure Resources and Cox Radio. They purported to check every box. They required that a majority tender. They promised a second-step merger. The offer was purportedly not coercive, and they appointed a special committee and ultimately gave it the authority to negotiate. Nevertheless, even if we were to accept all of these premises as true, the resulting transaction was the product of a breach of virtually every fiduciary duty that defendants owed to the minority shareholders of Cox Radio. Immediately prior to the transactions, defendant breached their duty of candor, repeatedly saying one thing to the public and another among themselves. At the same time, they breached their duty of loyalty, using corporate assets to facilitate and further a transaction that benefited them disproportionately to other shareholders. In connection with the transaction itself, Cox Enterprise breached its duty of fair dealing as measured by virtually every one of the indicia identified in Weinberger. The timing of the transaction, how it was initiated, structured, how it was disclosed, how it was negotiated, and how the approvals were obtained. The reportedly independent directors breached their fiduciary duty to attempt to negotiate the best price possible under the circumstances. Instead, to the extent that they negotiated at all, they negotiated the aptly named clearance price, which represented not the highest price, but the lowest common denominator at which the deal could be effected.
Now, all of these claims have been settled as a result of the proceedings below. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what is our standard of review of the Vice Chancellor's decision?
I believe the standard of review is, number one, that the Vice Chancellor applied the wrong legal standard in evaluating the strength and validity of the claims. He applied the business judgment rule when the entire fairness rule should have been applied. And secondly, with respect to, at a minimum, It represents a mixed application of law and facts, which also is reviewable de novo by this court.
Well, that sounds like a different standard of review than what we announced in Ray Philadelphia Stock Exchange, which is abuse of discretion. Is it?
I think if you're applying the long legal standard, Your Honor, and maybe I'm not up to speed on that, but wrong legal standard has always been an abuse of discretion, and I don't believe the defendants challenged that in their reply to our brief.
So you agree that the overarching standard of review is abuse of discretion, then?
Not if they applied the wrong legal standard, Your Honor. I think that this court can view the settlement de novo in determining whether the court applied the law correctly.
Maybe I can pursue that matter a little bit further. In determining whether a settlement is to be approved or not, the trial court exercises its business judgment, does it not?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And the trial court does not make findings as it would at the end of a trial, hearing all the evidence and evaluating competing theories of liability, correct?
I do not dispute that either.
Okay, so what you have is a partially developed set of claims that have been resolved in a certain fashion, and the trial court is being asked to approve this settlement as being fair and in the best interest of the stockholders,
yes.
Right? That being the case, is it necessary to make a determination as to what standard of review would have applied had this case been decided on the merits?
Well, I think, Your Honor, you're determining the validity and strength of the claims. In any settlement, you're measuring the settlement consideration received in relation to the strength of the claims. And so clearly, what legal standard should be applied to determining the claims is critical to that weighing of the competing factors.
But I thought the trial court, in recognition of the fact that there is some level of controversy, if you will, as to the appropriate standard to apply to this type of transaction, that the trial court first said, as a matter of business judgment, this was a fair settlement. And then said, even if entire fairness were the standard, this is a fair settlement. Am I right that that's basically what he said?
Yes, I agree. But at the same time, he also said that that the claims asserted in the federal complaint involving the pre-transaction conduct stated a claim for relief, and the law is clear that the settlement for a nominal amount of colorable, viable claims is not appropriate.
Well, how do you say that this was a nominal amount?
Well, Your Honor, I think the evidence is clear, the undisputed record, starting with Mr. Dyer's affidavit. I mean, one of the things that I'd like to emphasize, and I don't mean to back off, is that not many of the facts here are in dispute, because it's a very limited discovery record, and frankly, the objectors didn't have an opportunity to review that discovery record until after they had filed their objections. So the discovery record is the record that the defendants placed into evidence, and there are very few facts that are in dispute, and Mr. Dyer made very clear that the impetus for the bump in the price had nothing to do with the litigation, but was driven by Cox Enterprises, what they needed to get or what price they needed to offer in order to successfully complete the tender offer.
So, they were looking for a majority of the minority, and they thought they had to raise the consideration to get those votes. Is that right?
Exactly. But
regardless of the reasoning, the other undisputed fact is that the original price went up, 25% or more, which one would normally think of as being a noticeable improvement as opposed to a de minimis improvement.
Yes, Justice Berger, but I would the issue is, what is the consideration for the settlement? And if a plaintiff's attorney is presented with a situation where the price has been raised, she is not receiving any consideration for the release of claims. Alternatively, the plaintiff could theoretically have said, "My job is done. I have the claim has been mooted, the price has been raised, and the case is over." No, because there's a release. There's a release of claims, and it's the release. What is the consideration for the release of the claims? That's the critical issue.
So you're saying that the court has to separate out from the change in the value of what was being offered to the stockholders, what portion of that, if any, represents the consideration for the federal claims?
Yes. If that is not consideration for the settlement, then I don't believe that that can be included in the settlement consideration. That is my position. I'd like to go then to the court's application of the various legal standards, and first is application of the Pure Resources standard. Pure Resources creates a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, that if a controlling shareholder follows certain procedural safeguards that ensures the transaction approximates arm's length negotiation, the court will not apply the entire fairness review, but presume that the challenged transaction was the product of business judgment. But Pure Resources did not say, and to my knowledge, no court of equity has stated, that if you follow the letter of the law, or in this instance, the letter of the procedure, but you engage in inequitable conduct that results in a transaction that is unfair and inequitable to minority shareholders, the court will wash its hands of it under the business judgment rule. Pure Resources does not provide a safe harbor. It does not provide absolution to controlling shareholders to engage in all sorts of inequitable behavior without triggering fiduciary duties. And whether you analyze the facts of this case through the prism of the so-called Brash exception, or whether you analyze them through the prism of more general equitable principles, there were in this case numerous instances of inequitable conduct both prior to the freeze-out and during it that corrupted the process and enabled Cox Enterprise to misuse its position to obtain Cox Radio at a clearance price. First, defendants breached their duty of loyalty by means of the share repurchase program. This program utilized company resources in a manner that benefited Cox Enterprises in three ways. Permitted Cox to acquire shares at a lower price than they would have had to pay if they had made an offer themselves. It reduced the number of shares that CEI had to acquire by 75% to effect a Siliconic-style tender offer. And whether intended or not, it had the effect of leveraging Cox's radio's balance sheet, creating the purported crisis that necessitated the freeze-out. Second, defendants breached their duty of candor. They repeatedly said one thing to the market when internally they were saying the exact opposite among themselves. Defendants were informing market that the share repurchase program represented an attractive investment when internally they were of the view that it was unattractive. Throughout the relevant period, right up until the very end, defendants repeatedly assured investors about the strength of Cox Radio's balance sheet and leverage radios, particularly as it related to the share repurchase programs. All the while, Cox Enterprises was reducing its own balance sheet. Indeed, virtually the day before Cox Enterprises determined to go forward with the freeze-out, Cox Radio Management was informing the market that Cox Radio had the strongest balance sheet in the industry. These misstatements standing alone constitute breaches of fiduciary duty, but of equal importance, they evidence the bad faith that permeated every other aspect of this deal. Defendants prepared projections to justify the merger, which out of step with prior projections created shortly before and which were out of step with subsequent projections. The transaction itself was one-sided with respect to the timing. It was done almost to the day that Cox Radio traded at its lowest price. How it was initiated in a crisis atmosphere with a hurried deadline. It was structured to provide the minority shareholders with as few protections as possible, and it was disclosed out of the blue in a manner and completely at odds with prior disclosures. With respect to the negotiations, the special committee blessed a price rejected by 97% of the public shareholders.
which is a strong indicium of how vigorously the special committee negotiated. Then, to the extent that they did purport to negotiate, the committee didn't negotiate to obtain the highest price. It obtained the clearance price, which is a clear violation of fiduciary duty. In short, this process was flawed at every turn. No evidence that any protections were provided to minority shareholders. Thus, while the process may have comported with a letter of pure, it did not comport with its substance. And this leads me to my second point, going to the Lynch argument, which demonstrates that these factors demonstrate forcefully why the entire fairness standard should have been applied from the outset in this case and why it should be applied in all two-step transactions. Every transaction advised by competent counsel adheres to procedures outlined by the Delaware courts. Virtually every transaction provides the mechanism called for, or comparable mechanisms called for in Pure and CNX. Indeed, every case in which I have been involved in my years practicing before the court, the defendants complied purported to comply with procedural safeguard and involved a process that at first glance appeared to provide safeguards comparable to those called for in Pure. It was only after peeling away the first layer and examining what actually was done that the inadequacies of the process manifested themselves. If a controlling shareholder can invoke the business judgment at the pleading stage, such examination may not occur, and many cases in which wrongdoing has occurred will die stillborn. Even assuming that the pure reasoning is right and there is some advantage to allowing controlling shareholders a non-litigious means to acquiring the minority shares, such advantage is far outweighed by eviscerating the strongest protections that minority shareholders have. Controlling shareholders hold all the cards in these situations. They have the information, the means, and they have control of the corporate machinery to affect their desired outcome. It is the exceptional special committee, not the normal one, that can truly negotiate at arm's length. Recognition of that fact is what underpins Lynch, and it should underpin examination of two-step transaction as well. I'd just like to go back to some of your questions, Justice Berger, before I finish. I think what is remarkable about this case, and even if the abuse of discretion standard were to apply, it is our position that the judge did abuse his discretion. What is remarkable in this case is how little evidence, and I think it's reflected in the briefs submitted by the defendants and the plaintiffs, what little evidence there is that there was any indicia of fairness in this transaction. The evidence is undisputed. It is evidence that was presented by defendants as to particularly the process by which the special committee negotiated this transaction. And it is quite clear that they did not negotiate the best price. By their own admission, they did not strive to negotiate the best price in this transaction. They negotiated the clearance price. And that is entirely inconsistent with this court's decision in Tremont, which says if the process is flawed, the fact that a price somehow comes within the bottom of a range of fairness is not adequate. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
Appellants come here today desperately trying to present themselves as something other than what they are, in a meritless effort to avoid the effect of a release that was given in connection with the settlement of the matter in the court below. Indeed, they are but a tag-along case filed in a different jurisdiction while expedited litigation was conducted in the court below. They seek now to present themselves as something more than having more than what the claims were that were litigated below in an effort to be able enable themselves to continue their litigation going forward. The benefits that were conferred in connection with the settlement in the court below are substantial, and certainly provide enough consideration for the release that was given in that case. There was an additional $17 million in additional consideration given to shareholders as a result of several factors. We never claimed that plaintiff's counsel were the only factor that resulted in the increased consideration, but one of several, and as such, were to be accorded certain credit for that benefit that was conferred on the shareholders. Certainly, plaintiff's counsel were the sole reason for the additional disclosures that were made in connection with the tender offer prior to its closing. an additional benefit, which the court did recognize in the court below, was the impact that a plaintiff's litigation in the lower court had on the process, which ultimately resulted in the special committee being fully empowered to negotiate, thus the special committee being empowered to be another factor which contributed to the financial benefit. Appellants asked this court to ignore the factual record below, the arm's-length negotiations that were conducted between the parties, the sound judgment of the Chancery Court, and the overwhelming weight of Delaware authority that supports the settlement approval. Settlements based upon facts and circumstances and legal analyses identical to those in the case at bar and others similar to it. The standard for this request is high, as this court has noted, and in order to succeed, they must show that the lower court's decision constituted an abuse of discretion, which can only be done by showing the existence of evidence that is strongly to the contrary to the court's ruling. Indeed, they have provided no evidence of this whatsoever.
Do you agree that applying the wrong legal standard would be an abuse of discretion?
I don't, Your Honor. We believe that the decisions of the trial court clearly have undeniably evolved concerning the standard and which is the proper to apply. In the context of a settlement, however, first the parties themselves have to consider what is the standard that's going to apply to the facts that I'm trying to litigate here. Will it be entire fairness? Will it be pure resources or some other standard that has been articulated by the Chancery Court? But this court's not being asked to consider here today what the appropriate standard is, but whether the lower court properly considered, among other things, the nature and strength of plaintiff's claims below in ultimately deciding whether the release of claims in connection with the proposed settlement should be approved. And in fact, the court did consider both pure resources and entire fairness and concluded that under either standard, the strength of the claims was such that the benefits being achieved as part of the settlement were sufficient to support the release of claims being provided.
Let me state my question another way.
Certainly.
You saying that applying the wrong legal standard is never an abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that. But in the context in which we are today, where the standard has evolved over the course of 10 or 13 years, arising out of the decisions of this court, of Kahn and Solomon, and going from Siliconics and Aquila and Pure Resources and through a few other cases since then, there is a structure under which defendants choose to put together their transactions so that they can hopefully gain business judgment deference to their transaction. And these are the cases within which plaintiffs' counsel must litigate and pursue their cases in the lower court as well.
Well, in this case, there are two ways to look at it. And do you begin with Pure Resources or do you begin with Kahn? But in this case, the Court of Chancery said, I'm going to begin with Pure Resources, and the argument is under Pure Resources that the Court of Chancery should have concluded the business judgment rule had been rebutted, and then you would have moved to entire fairness. So assuming that the plaintiffs had a point that even under Pure Resources, the court should have moved to entire fairness. The Court of Chancery in this case got to entire fairness anyway. Whether it began there or it wound up there, in approving this settlement, it concluded that no matter where it began, if you ultimately ended with entire fairness, it should approve the settlement anyway. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Although I believe that we have to remind ourselves that we're in the context of a settlement and not in the context of a preliminary injunction, where the issue of the standard is the issue. In fact, it is, when parties come to the table to negotiate, they consider the strengths of their claims and the weaknesses and the benefits that the risk of continued litigation versus the benefits of the settlement. And in doing so, we as plaintiff's counsel in the court below consider the standard that will be applied to the actions of the defendants. That helps us weigh our decision. And I think that's exactly what the court did.
Well, in this case, though, we know the price increased. And that seems to be relevant when people are asking for attorney's fees later to show that you filed suit, the price increased, and there's a presumption that you contributed to that. The concern your opponents have is that in evaluating the value of the settlement, there really wasn't a specific identification of the value of the federal claim.
Right. I don't think that there's any precedent for requiring that to be so.
No, I understand that, but my question is that not a fact? Did the court say the federal claim is worthless or I assign this value to it? How did the court deal with the federal claim that was going to be released?
I think the court rightly considered all the claims that were being released and weighed them against the benefits of the settlement and found, as evidence in the record, that the financial benefits were significant, the disclosures were significant, and noted the benefit of, you know, the process which ended up with the special committee being fully empowered. And I don't think that the court did separate and did not was not required to separate the federal claims to find some separate consideration for the release of those claims. Whether they were strong or weak, to step back a second, we believe that the federal case was an identical case to the one that was litigated in Chancery Court, and they have couched certain claims that are identical to ours as federal claims. And whether that's proper, is a matter that I think the court must have considered. It's not set forth in the record below, but certainly the court did consider all the claims that were being released, including the federal claims, and included a discussion of those claims throughout the course of the hearing. We would also ask the court to consider the motivations of the appellants as litigants in this related federal action to, through this appeal, bolster their position in that case. Indeed, out of thousands of notices concerning the settlement that were issued, only two objections were lodged in opposition to the settlement, both by parties with what we believe to be ulterior motives to bolster their leverage in related litigation. Nothing has been presented to this court today supports any finding that the court below abused its discretion in approving the settlement. We believe that the court below, the lower court properly considered the strength of plaintiffs came below and ultimately deciding to approve the settlement and in fact wrote a 58-page opinion after more than 4 hours of oral argument, considered all the parties' briefing, and ultimately concluded that based on the wealth of precedent before us that the settlement was fair, reasonable, and adequate and should be approved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. I'm here today on behalf of the CEI defendants, the controlling stockholder in this transaction. I will attempt to explain 3 points to Your Honors, which I hope will lead the Court to affirm the lower court's approval of the settlement. First, I will explain why this Court does not need to resolve the continuing debate over the applicable standard of review for a controlling stockholder go private in order to affirm the settlement approval by the trial court. Second, I will explain under the correct application of the abuse of discretion standard that governs this court's consideration of the settlement approval, we submit that the settlement should be affirmed. Finally, I'll explain briefly why the federal claims and the stock repurchase claim raised by Dixon in his federal complaint are the proper subject of a release in this settlement because of their make-weight nature. First, with respect to the standard of review, the Supreme Court does not need to resolve this issue in order to affirm the settlement approval. Regardless of the applicable standard that was discussed by the Vice Chancellor, as Justice Berger recognized, there is ultimately an exercise of business judgment by the trial court to determine whether the settlement consideration benefits outweigh the purported strength of the claims being settled. The settlement was proper under the entire fairness standard in this case because the Vice Chancellor found that the plaintiffs and the objectors faced, open quotes, significant hurdles to succeed, close quotes, under even the strictest standard of review. The Dixon objectors seem not to have read pages 32 to 35 of the lower court's opinion, whereas I believe Justice Berger has recognized, the trial court expressly stated that even if entire fairness applies, the claims should be resolved by the settlement because of their weak nature. The lower court initially found that the defendants had a reasonable likelihood of success in shifting the burden of proof under the entire fairness standard because the special committee was duly empowered, independent, and properly functioned. The Vice Chancellor then went on in pages 32 to 35 to independently assess the three unfair dealing claims that were raised by the appraisal objectors, and he rejected all of them as either weak or factually unsupported. First, the trial court found there was, open quotes, no evidence, close quotes, that CEI improperly timed the transaction. Second, the court found that there was, open quotes, no evidence, close quotes, that CEI manipulated the CXR projections that were relied upon by the special committee. Finally, the trial court found that there were only, open quotes, weak claims, close quotes, with respect to the purported pressure by CEI on the special committee to make a prompt decision. So the whole question of the procedural fairness of the transaction under an entire fairness rubric was expressly addressed by the trial court. And Vice Chancellor Parsons went on to address the fairness of the price. The lower court reviewed the evidence on the fairness of the price and specifically cited the fact that the 480 was at the high end or exceeded the DCF ranges created by multiple experts, that the failure of many CXR stockholders to seek appraisal was a factor that weighed in fairness in favor of a finding of the fairness of the price, and the court focused on the premium over the market in assessing the adequacy of 480. Ultimately, the court concluded that there was, open quotes, no known discrepancy, close quotes, between the appraisal value and the tender offer price. So the Vice Chancellor clearly applied the entire fairness test to assess the strength of the objector's claims against the go-private transaction, and there's no basis to remand for reconsideration of the settlement in light of the fact that the strictest standard of judicial review currently known under Delaware corporate law was expressly applied by the Vice Chancellor. So regardless of how the Supreme Court ultimately chooses to resolve the continuing debate between Kahn and Solomon, Siliconics, and the trilogy of Chancery Court opinions, you don't need to reach that question because in this case, under the abuse of discretion standard, the decision should be affirmed. There are very specific legal and factual findings on key issues by the Chancery Court that are supported by the record and reflect the correct application of entire fairness law as currently articulated by this court. The Chancery Court articulated in detail the basis for its conclusion that the settlement provides adequate consideration to offset the weak claims. In an entire section of the opinion, section 2B4, the Vice Chancellor explicitly balanced the weakness of the claims against the benefits provided by the settlement, including the decision by my client to pay $17 million in part to settle these claims and to get a release. Vice Chancellor Parsons expressly found that in his business judgment, the release claims have no significant value, have no reasonable probability of success, and that they are offset by the benefits of the settlement, including the partial payment of the $17 million and the supplemental disclosures that were made. Under the abuse of discretion standard that governs this appeal, the evidence must be, open quotes, strongly contrary, close quotes, to the lower court's findings. As I interpret the application of that standard in this context, the Supreme Court would have to find that the lower court's determinations are effectively off the wall and that the appraisal objectors have a significant probability of success in prevailing on their claims. That's the exact opposite, of course, of what the Vice Chancellor found. And in light of the detailed factual findings made by the court, I think it's impossible for this court to logically conclude that the appraisal objectors had a probability of success on their factual, legal, and economic claims. The objectors have failed to cite to any decision by this court in which the Chancery Court's approval of a settlement has been set aside as an abuse of discretion. I'm not aware of one either. The objectors have also failed to cite any decision by this court in which the Chancery Court's decision to approve a settlement was predicated upon a finding that there was an adequate discovery record to consider the settlement. I'm not aware of any such decision either. Given the explicit factual findings by the lower court and the application of the law by Vice Chancellor Parsons, the detailed and lengthy settlement approval decision should not be second-guessed. We respectfully submit as an abuse of discretion. But Justice Ridgely asked the question as to whether the application of an improper legal standard automatically means that the trial court's approval of the settlement has to be set aside. And I think there's a legal answer to that and a case-specific answer to that question that we would urge you to consider. First, in the Amstead decision issued by this court in 1989, the Supreme Court stated that, open quotes, when the Court of Chancery reviews the fairness of a settlement, it must evaluate all of the circumstances of the settlement by using its own business judgment. Thus, while we might find error if a faulty legal standard were employed, it must be stressed that the Court of Chancery's most important yardstick of a settlement's fairness is its business judgment. So the Amstead decision sets a framework in which the Supreme Court conceivably could find error in the application of the law by the trial court and nevertheless conclude that the settlement benefits outweighed the value of the claims and still approve the settlement. But that's an interesting doctrinal issue that may be relevant in some other case. But, of course, it's not relevant here because the trial court applied the correct legal standard. It's either pure resources, in which case we win, it's in terms of the settlement approval, or, as the court found on pages 32 to 35, you can apply entire fairness, and all of the procedural unfairness claims are factually unsupported or quite weak, and the court also directly assessed the fair price claim that could arise under the rubric of entire fairness and found that claim wanting as well. So we respectfully urge the court to affirm because there is no abuse of discretion in a 58-page opinion containing these types of detailed factual findings, legal findings, and ultimately a determination that the 480 price appears more than fair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The special committee defendants adopt the arguments that you've heard from my colleagues. The vice chancellor correctly concluded that the claims below were weak and the settlement fair. I'd like to spend a moment, if I may, though, on the process of the special committee, because that's been alluded to here today. There is no dispute that the committee members were fully independent, that they retained independent and professional advisors. Those are givens. But the objector complains that the committee somehow couldn't negotiate or didn't negotiate or negotiated for the wrong thing. This is baseless. The vice chancellor so found and the record so established. In fact, once the committee received the clear authority to negotiate that it sought, its negotiations were robust, the vice chancellor's words, and successful. It withdrew its recommendation. It rejected 380. It rejected 420. It rejected 442. It rejected 470. It achieved 480, a dollar more, 26%, as Justice Berger commented, $17 million more to the shareholders. That's not the mark of an abject committee. What about this clearance price myth? The objector simply misunderstands the concept. I don't fault the objector for not understanding it, but it's a pretty simple concept. The special committee was concerned that the shareholders have a real opportunity to tender given the risk of a debt leverage covenant default that they were presented with. So obviously they had to consider the likelihood that a majority of the minority, in fact, would tender so that the condition of the offer would actually be met. That's all clearance price is about. And the claim that the committee was seeking the lowest price rather than the upper ranges being the testimony actually given as to what they were seeking, is simply contrary to the record. Whether, Your Honor, we need to...
Mr. Nolan, your time is up.
May I? I'll just complete that,
yep.
If I may.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
I would just like to address a couple of points. The first one goes to what exactly is the settlement consideration? If the price had been negotiated upwards and plaintiff had filed its suit after the price had been negotiated and then settled, I think this court would have no difficulty in coming to the conclusion that the plaintiff received nothing in consideration for settling the case. If the plaintiff files the suit and beforehand and the price is raised without regard to the lawsuit, and the lawsuit is then presented with a new set of facts to go forward, the same principle applies. There was the price had been increased, and no one is disputing that plaintiff's counsel had a claim for a fee. The issue is, given that set of circumstances where the price had been increased, was there any consideration, the deal was going to go forward in any event, was there any consideration for the release of all the claims? And its plaintiff's position is that there was no consideration for the release of all the claims. And also something that plaintiff's counsel said
is the court in determining the settlement is whether it properly considered the nature and strength of the plaintiff's claims. And I think the legal standard to be applied is critical to any consideration of the nature and the strength of the plaintiff's claims. And the court can review any legal determination de novo. With respect to the whether the committee properly functioned and the court's determination that the committee properly functioned, the evidence is undisputed that the committee sanctioned the price that was rejected by 97% of the public shareholders. 3% of the public shareholders said this price was the price that the special committee said was fair. Only 3% of the shareholders agreed with them. I think that's very strong evidence that there was no negotiation. But that's not the point that I'm driving at. The point is that the committee was not negotiating the best price possible. That is undisputed. The concern, if you read Mr. Dyer's affidavit and you read the testimony of the committee and you read the deposition of the investment banker, his deposition testimony was unequivocal. What was the clearance price? The clearance price was the price that we could get people to accept. That was the minimum price that we could get a majority of the minority to accept. And for the court to say that obtaining the minimum price and as a result of a process where the committee misunderstood its mission is reversible legal error. And the court reversed on exactly those grounds in the Tremont decision.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.